You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And happy Friday, Shabbat Shalom, Jumu'ah Mubarak, TGIF, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you, our first hour on Friday, as always, our national town hall meeting with Senator Bernie Sanders. Senator Sanders, greetings.
How are you, Tom? Good to be with you.
I am fine. Thanks for joining us. You just came back from a vote in the Senate.
I did, and I am at the airport, and I apologize for the cell phone, but that's the best I think we could do this afternoon.
Yeah, well, it sounds pretty good, so it's better on a cell phone than nothing. And thank you. Thank you for being with us. Your thoughts on this week? A lot has happened.
Well, it has been an interesting week, to say the least. I think, as everybody knows, the Supreme Court, by a 5-4 vote, with Chief Justice Roberts going with the majority, approved and indicated that the Affordable Care Act that we passed is, in fact, constitutional. And while I voted for the health care reform bill, to my mind, it is a step forward, but we have to do better. What this bill does and what the Supreme Court affirmed is that we can go forward in making sure that insurance companies cannot deny health care to people who have pre-existing conditions. If you are a family that has health insurance and you have kids under 26, they will still be able to retain their coverage. If you end up with a serious illness like cancer and heart disease, you're running up a big bill, there is a maximum. They cannot remove your coverage because your needs are terribly great. If you are a woman, you cannot be discriminated against, and women are, in terms of the cost of health care. And there are, if you are in need of pre-disease prevention, preventative health care, you're going to be able to get this under this act. So this, and if you are one of 30 million Americans who today has no health insurance, in the coming years, you will be eligible for Medicaid, which is a significant step forward in providing health insurance to those who do not have it. Our Republican friends are arguing that this mandate, the individual mandate, is going to be a tax on millions of people. The truth is that if you have insurance today, or if you're on Medicaid, or if you're on Medicare, you're not going to pay a nickel in that penalty. What this is about, and it's something, of course, that goes on in Massachusetts, where Governor Romney, when he was governor there, passed this. It says the following, Tom. It says that if you are, say, 35 and you're jogging along and you think you're invincible and you're never going to get sick and you have no health insurance, you say, I don't need any health insurance. I'm pretty healthy. And you're jogging along on some road and you get hit by a truck and you run up a $100,000 bill. Today, it is people who have insurance who are cost-shifted who end up paying for your hospitalization. And that costs people over $1,000 each all over America. So if you have health insurance and somebody runs up a huge health care bill in the hospital, you are paying for that. So what this says, if you can afford it, if you can't afford it, you don't have to do it. But if you can afford it, which is the case in Massachusetts right now, you have to get at least some kind of health insurance. Other people don't have to pick up the burden for you. And if you are lower income, you can't afford it. Well, you don't have to do that. You will be getting a subsidy to get your insurance. Now, I myself believe and have believed from day one, that there is something wrong in this country when the United States is the only nation on earth that does not guarantee health care for all people as a right. This bill takes us a step forward, in my view, to take us to the finish line, to do what we should be doing, to provide quality care to every man, woman, and child as a right. We need to pass a Medicare for All single-payer program. We need to get private health insurance companies whose only goal in life is to make as much money as possible out of the picture. We have to negotiate with the drug companies to end the absurdity of us paying the highest prices in the world for prescription drugs. But having said that, we're not there yet, and I hope my small state of Vermont will lead the nation in that direction. But having said that, is this health care reform bill a step forward? it will be for many, many millions of people, by the way, including seniors, who will see a closing to some degree of their donut hole, which means they will be paying less in prescription drugs. So this is a step forward. I'm glad the Supreme Court agreed with its constitutionality, but we have got to continue the effort to provide health care to all people in a more cost-effective way than we are currently doing.
Mitt Romney raised $3 million yesterday after this came out. He sent out an email. I'm apparently on his list. And dear friend Tom, and is suggesting that this is a $1.7 trillion tax hike, and it's going to be a $500 billion cut in Medicare. You want to take a whack at those numbers?
They just pulled this stuff right out of their ear. In other words, they're frightening, you know, everybody. The truth of the matter is that, as I just mentioned, the so-called individual mandate will apply to some 5% of the people. And frankly, you know, if you can afford to have health insurance, and it's wrong to say that other people have got to pick up your health care cost if you end up with a serious disease. It's, you know, that is what freeloading is about. Many of my Republican friends, you know, they want individual responsibility. Well, what individual responsibility is about is if you have the money and you get sick, other people, or you have an accident, you have a heart attack, other people should not have to be paying more for their health insurance through cost shifting to pick up your needs. You should have to contribute. And that's what that provision is about. But again, having said that, I think the most cost-effective way to go forward to provide universal health care to all of our people is through a Medicare for All single-payer program. You will save hundreds of billions of dollars in terms of administrative costs. Right now we spend 30% of our health care dollars on administration. That's totally absurd. Money should be spent on health care and not profiteering for insurance companies, high CEO salaries, et cetera, et cetera. So now I should also say, to get off the health care for a moment, I just came from the floor an hour ago where we voted on a not insignificant transportation bill, which will start to rebuild our crumbling roads and bridges and public transportation systems. This bill did not go as far as I would like, again, but it took us months and months and months. We passed the bill a couple of months ago out of the Senate. It had 74 votes. It was, in fact, a bipartisan bill. And we finally got the House to act just today. So that, at a time when our infrastructure, that is our roads, our bridges, public transportation, has so many needs. In my state of Vermont, just we have many, many bridges which are in serious shape, really need a whole lot of work. And that's true all over this country. We're going to begin to put about 1.8 million jobs a year by continuing to work on infrastructure and, in fact, create another million more. So this bill is good for, I think, 27 months. It's going to pump a lot of money into our economy. And, in fact, it's probably the most significant job-creating bill that we have passed in quite a while.
Will we see an immediate result from that, do you think?
Pardon me?
Will we see an immediate result from that?
I think you will. I think as a result of this passage, you're going to see billions of dollars going right into the economy, mm-hmm. and you're going to see people going to work. So the estimate is that we're going to save about 1.8 million jobs in construction that would have been lost if we didn't pass this, plus another million jobs as a result of this bill. Not an insignificant number.
Marvelous. It is our national town hall meeting, Brunch with Bernie. Senator Bernie Sanders on the line with us, taking your calls in our national town hall meeting. Also, check out Senator Sanders' website, sanders.senate.gov. We'll be right back with your calls for Bernie right after this.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Sanders.Senate.gov. Also, you can drop by TomHartman.com as well and drop into our free live chat room. Participate in our blogs. There's all kinds of cool stuff there, too.
All the energies of government and business must be directed to increasing the national income, to putting more people into private jobs, to giving security and a feeling of security to all people in all walks of life.
Welcome back to our Brunch with Bernie Hour, our national town hall meeting with Senator Bernie Sanders, sanders.senate.gov, his website. Stephen in Columbia, Missouri, you're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Hello, thank you for taking my call. And I just would like to propose that for all these Republicans who are so adamantly opposed to universal health care and Obamacare, why can't they just sign a pledge that if and when they get sick, they agree they will not visit any doctor, dentist, or hospital in regards to addressing their health problems if they don't want to pay the necessary fees to have health insurance for everyone?
Well, Stephen, that is a very interesting concept, and it really touches on where we are as a nation today with regard to health care. And remember, Stephen, the key point here is every other major nation on earth, Europe, Scandinavia, Canada, every major economy on earth provides health care as a right of all people because they have reached the conclusion as to whether you're poor, middle class, wealthy, health care is a basic human need and everybody is entitled to it. We are the only major country on earth that has not reached that decision. So where we are today in terms of healthcare is if you are in the top 1%, you will gain access to the best healthcare probably in the world. You will gain access to breakthrough medicines and brand new technologies that may cost tens and tens of thousands of dollars, but you can afford it. On the other hand, if you are, and I've talked to physicians in Vermont and around the country on this, if you're a working class person today, just for an example, you're going to walk into your doctor's office. Doctor will diagnose your illness, write out a prescription, and some 25, 30, 40% of the people in this country can't even afford to fill that prescription. Meanwhile, you got millions more who can't afford to walk into the doctor's office in the first place. And as I mentioned earlier, you got 45,000 people who die every year because they delay going to the doctor when they should. So we have an irrational system. It does work very well, and I have to admit this, for the top 1%. They have access to great doctors, great hospitals, great technologies, great medicine that they can afford. But if you're in the middle class, if you're in the working class, if you're a lower income, well, you're not doing so well. And that is the great challenge that we face as a nation. How do we provide health care to all people as a right? And to answer Stephen's point, when you do that, when you keep people well rather than forcing them, rather than denying them the health care that they need, I think you do create a healthier society and a more productive society. And by the way, keeping people healthy is a lot cheaper than treating them when they're very, very ill.
Craig in Orlando, Florida. You're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Yes, hello, Mr. Sanders. My question is this. Next week, Congressman Issa is supposed to push his postal bill. What I'd like to know is why one man who's one of the richest wants to destroy my brother's and sister's career with his privatized postal bill without it letting any other bills from the Senate and from the House through to save us.
Well, Greg, that's a very, very good question. And then this gets back to, you know, I don't want to be hyper-partisan, you know, on this show. But I think most Americans who follow politics understand that what you have right now is a House of Representatives controlled not just by Republicans, but by Republican right-wing extremists. And what you have are folks who, in their heart of hearts, and that's what the Ryan budget was significantly about, want to end Medicare as we know it today, transform Medicare into a voucher program where you give a senior $7,000 or $8,000 and you send them on their way to some private insurance company. They want to make massive cuts in Medicaid. They want to make massive cuts in federal aid to education and in Pell Grants and in the Environmental Protection Agency. So consistent with all of that, Craig, is an attack on the Postal Service. They don't like the Postal Service, and they would like to, at least a number of them, privatize it and let FedEx or UPS pick up the rest, pick up what the Postal Service is now doing. Now, as you may know, Ukraine, about 10 months ago or so, the Postmaster General came up with an extraordinarily radical proposal. And what he proposed is to shut down about 15,000 post offices in America, most of them rural, shut down half of the processing plants in this country, and end Saturday mail delivery service. And when you do that, you go from a workforce in the Postal Service of about 520,000 down to 320,000. Some of us in the Senate responded very, very strongly to that. We passed a bill, didn't go as far as I would want, but what we passed in the Senate was the shutting down of no rural post offices. There will be cuts in hours. We managed to not see half of the processing plants in America shut down. Some of them will be shut down. And at this moment, Saturday mail delivery service still continues. So there will be a reduction in size in the Postal Service, but nowhere near as severe as what the Postmaster General originally wanted. Now, what the Postmaster General did after a lot of discussion with many of us, more or less adopted what was in the Senate bill, more or less. Now the bill is going to the House, and we will see what happens there. But this is an issue I have been involved in, and I am going to do everything that I can to prevent the Postal Service from being privatized and to see a huge number of decent-paying jobs, union jobs, from being destroyed.
Bernie, you said you didn't want to be hyper-partisan. You remind me of Harry Truman. He said, I don't give them hell, I just tell them the truth, and they think it's hell.
Tom, that's about it. I mean, that really is true.
Bernie, Rain, our call screener, just heard from your office who said that you have to leave at 3:30. And so I'm going to put you on hold if that's definitely the case. Thank you for being with us today. And if not, we'll catch you on the other side of the break.
Okay.
Thank you, Bernie.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
We'll be back with Anything Goes Friday, maybe with Bernie, but probably with everything Anything Goes Friday right after this, 28 minutes past the hour. Almost anything. Welcome back to the True People's Media, the Tom Hartman Program. Our apologies, Bernie's apologies as well, that the airline changed his flight departure time, and his aide knew about it, but he didn't because he was on the phone with us. And so we got a call and an email here from his office saying that his flight is actually leaving in about 6 minutes from this minute, so he had to run like a bunny over to his airplane. And somehow Bernie running like a bunny doesn't make sense, but you get the point. And yeah, Paul says bad analogy, bad metaphor. So I've got a whole take on this healthcare thing, which I will share with you in the next hour. But let's just pick up calls again. No need to say I wish I could have talked to Bernie because we're all bummed out about that. But maybe I can help you, or maybe if you just want to vent. So Don in Seminole, Florida. Hey, Don. What's up?
Yeah, I'm sorry I missed the senator. I just wanted to tell him, or I don't know if he can hear this.
He can't, Don. I'm sorry. He's gone. Andrew in Northport, Washington. Hey, Andrew.
Hi, how you doing?
Fine. What's on
your mind? I Googled this question 100 different ways. I can't get the answer on health care. If I don't purchase health care and I get penalized, I get a penalty, mm-hmm. does that penalty now give me health care?
That's a good question. I don't know the answer to it. I believe that it does. I mean, that's my understanding, is that the whole point of the penalty is that everybody has access to health care.
I can't get the answer. I thought, can I walk into the doctor's office and say, I'm paying the penalty?
Right. Yeah, I'm paying it's up to $600 a year is the penalty, or up to 2.5% of your income. So if you're a millionaire, it could be a lot, $25,000 a year. But for people who make, at or below, I think 150% of the poverty line or something like that, the penalty is zero. But that's a question. That's a very, very good question for somebody like, Roger Hickey or Bob Borisage or some of these guys who were very into the self policy thing. I will try to find out. It's a very good question. Thank you. Henry in Marshall, Texas. Hey, hey, Henry, what's up?
Hey, thing I want to know is this. On this health, new health care deal and stuff, I wonder if they have any provisions in there whatsoever to drop the cost of medical school to where we have more doctors available for all the extra amount of people that we're going to have in health care.
Yeah. It's not just the cost. I mean, there's every medical school in this country turns away probably 8 or 9 kids for or young people for every one that they accept. The number of applicants, the number of people who can go through medical school is regulated by a board that's basically controlled by the American Medical Association. And so, you know, they're acting like an old-fashioned guild. They're keeping the price of doctors up by keeping the supply down. And I think we should be doing what Cuba is doing. Cuba is actually exporting doctors. They have so many extra doctors. And anybody can go to medical school in Cuba, and it's a fine thing. Craig, and this is true of a lot of countries, by the way. Craig in St. Louis, Missouri. Hey, Craig, what's up?
Hey, Tom. Yeah, I wanted to know on this new health care, why don't we make people that are over 55 and eligible for, you know, retirement be able to buy into Medicare? And that way, you know, a lot of people would go ahead and retire because they could get insurance, which they can't if they retire. And it opened up a lot of jobs and stuff for everybody else.
Yep. I've written several articles about this. It's an entire chapter in my book, Rebooting the American Dream. Drop the retirement eligibility age, both for Medicare and Social Security, down to 55. What you'll find is that probably half, maybe only a third, but some, you know, some significant fraction of people between 55 and 65 will say, fine, I'll retire now. I mean, a lot of them won't. They just, you know, love working. But enough will retire that it will open up, it'll tighten up the labor market, which means that wages will go up. It'll open up lots of opportunities for young people to get into the labor market, which is a really important thing for the next generation. And because it tightens up the labor market and wages go up, it'll increase tax revenues, which will pay for it. And this is, you know, France is doing this. They had dropped their eligibility age for retirement down to 60 back, I don't know, 15, 20 years ago. And then when Sarkozy came in, he's you know, kind of a right-wing version of George Bush, he jacked it up to 63, and it actually made unemployment worse because people were staying in the job market longer. And so now you have François Hollande, who has been elected, and his platform, and presumably he's going to do this, is to drop it back down to 60 and get those people back out of the labor market so that young people can get back into it. Although France, so it's an excellent suggestion, Craig. Although France doesn't have that much of an unemployment problem, I think their unemployment rate is between 5% and 6% right now, which is generally considered fairly reasonable. Denise in Wadena, Minnesota. Hey, Denise, what's up?
Hey, I wanted to talk about J.P. Morgan Chase, and I am not hearing hardly anything about their $9 billion loss.
Yeah, the $1 billion became $2 billion, which became $3 billion, and now we learn it's $9 billion. Yep.
Yeah. Yeah, I think we need to change the dialogue on this, and instead of referring to them as too big to fail, they're too dangerous to save.
Too dangerous to face. That's a good one.
If you have a bull loose in the China shop, you don't try to control it. You shoot the darn thing.
I mean,
we have a corporate death penalty.
Yes.
Remove the charter, break them up, get rid of the system.
Yeah.
I've had it. I mean, I'm a fourth customer of J.P. Morgan Chase. My house is financed through them. I've been trying to get them to refinance my house, and I sent the paperwork in 10 times. And they still have not done it.
Right.
First time I heard, nope, you don't have any income. The second time, oh, you're on unemployment. We can't. Third, fourth, fifth, sixth, seventh, eighth, and ninth time is we never got the paperwork. We didn't get this. I'm in the process of 10th time redoing all this paperwork.
Incredible.
Resending in everything. It's ridiculous.
Yeah. Yeah, it's a scam. Banking in this country, since it was deregulated in 99 and 2000 at the hand of Phil Graham, whose wife Wendy was on the board of Enron, and banking was deregulated so that Ken Lay could get into the banking business and so that he could get into speculating on energy futures. It's basically, you know, turned from a nice, boring part of the commons, really, in a way, you know, a nice, boring business that was predictable, heavily regulated, but predictable and safe from 1935 until 1999 turn from that into a gambling casino where gamblers go to try and get rich, and some of them get rich and some of them take our country down, take the world down for that matter. You're absolutely right, Denise. Mm-hmm. Thank you for pointing it out. Rob in Northeast Maryland. Hey, Rob, what's up?
Hey, Tom. You think you and I could catch that plane with Bernie and go down to Cayman Islands and liberate that $2.5 trillion of stolen tax money the corporations got down there hid?
Well, you know, yeah, you need to talk to Mitt Romney. He's got one of those Cayman Islands accounts. I think that's one of the ways that he's sheltering the $100 million he gave his sons, from what I read in the paper. But, yeah, you're right. There's a big problem. There's a big problem, Rob, and thank you for pointing it out, with money having gone offshore in ways that are designed to avoid U.S. federal income taxes. And right now, I mean, Mitt Romney wouldn't be doing it if it wasn't legal. Now, it's legal because multimillionaires and billionaires like Mitt Romney and his buddies buy members of Congress to pass these loopholes in the tax code. But that doesn't make it right, and we should do something about it. Linda in Deerfield Beach, Florida. Hey, Linda, what's up?
Hi, Tom. I saw you yesterday. I was watching you on TV yesterday, and I'm at work today. I have to listen to you. My post is dropped.
Uh-huh.
But I was curious. They said that they're going to get, each state is going to get either Medicaid or Medicare, and it's up to the governor to, you know, to accept it or not to accept it. And if they don't, the federal government steps in. Well, we know our governor has already said no.
Yeah, sort of not. Every state gets Medicare because Medicare is a federal program. It doesn't have state involvement. Medicaid is a kind of 50-50 deal where the federal government puts up half the money, the state puts up half the money. And for the first 3 years of Obamacare, starting next year, I believe, or maybe the year after, maybe it's 2014, but for the first 3 years, the federal government will pay 100% of the cost of expanding Medicaid. Medicaid is for poor people, and you don't have to be 65. You can qualify for Medicaid if you're a year old or 10 years old or 40 years old or whatever. And that will be fully paid for by the federal government for the first 3 years, and then the states begin paying a piece of it. But these Republican governors are saying that they're not going to take the money, and they're going to say to hell with the poor people because that's their ideology.
Yeah, but what happens to this? Then does the federal government just come in and take it over altogether?
Well, under the original Obamacare, the federal government would cut off all Medicaid funds to the states, which would make such a political disaster for the states that no governor in his right mind would refuse to go along with it. That was struck down by the Supreme Court yesterday. So that was the stick. The carrot is, here's 100% for the first 3 years. Now, what the governors are saying is, well, that's sort of like the heroin pusher saying, here's your first three doses for free. And there is some truth to that. I mean, you get people on the programs and get it working. But on the other hand, it's a good program, and the federal government's paying most of it. So, frankly, I think it's going to take pressure at the grassroots level. It's going to take, you know, people like you and me contacting our representative. I mean, it's a little hard here in D.C. We don't have representation, but you're in Florida, you know, contacting your state representatives, your state senators, and your governor, and saying, please take that Medicaid money and, you know, provide health care to people who are at or slightly above the poverty line. It's really important. Linda, thank you for the call. We'll be right back. 45 minutes past the hour here on the Tom Hartman program. Anything goes Friday. Bernie is on an airplane off to Vermont right now. We'll be back.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
And you can check out Bernie's website. Even though he's not with us, let me plug it. It is sanders.senate.gov. Check it out. Tom Hartman here with you. Anything goes Friday today. As I said, I want to get into at some length why we need to be very, very concerned about what happened at the Supreme Court yesterday and about our response to it and the Republican response to it. And I've given this a lot of thought, and I think that this is a really the rant that's coming up in the next hour, and then I'm going to be continuing in the third hour, I think is probably one of the most important things that I've had to say in a long time. So stick around for that. Caleb in Portland, Oregon. Hey, Caleb, what's up?
You know, first of all, I just wanted to say that we owe a lot of praise to someone who started this whole procedure, and that's Governor Romney. I mean, his idea succeeded yesterday in the Supreme Court. So
you know what was ironic? Did you see Romney's speech yesterday?
Yeah, okay. I think I did, where he said he would vote with the dissenting.
Place. Yeah, well, I'm just talking about the view of it. You could see the Capitol in the background, and there was this glass partition. I have been on top of that. I've been there where he spoke from. It's the roof of the building next door to us, which is the Heritage Foundation.
Uh-huh.
And I thought it was particularly ironic because here he is on the roof of the Heritage Foundation talking about knocking down Obamacare, which was a program originally proposed by the Heritage Foundation as an alternative to Hillary Care, and then put into place by Governor Romney in the state of Massachusetts. And he was talking about how evil it was. It was just the irony was almost beyond me, and I was astounded that nobody, zero, not one person in the corporate press picked up that fact. And anybody who lives in Washington, D.C. and knows the media scene in this town would know just from looking at that shot that he was on the roof of the Heritage Foundation. I mean, it's a well-known fact that they've got a really nice TV studio up there. They use it in the summertime. We're just three blocks from the Capitol building. You can see the shot. I mean, he's looking right down Second Street. I mean, I recognize it. It's the same view I have out of my windows.
And I would imagine great insurance for the heads of that organization, just as great insurance for the four dissenting Republican wackos on the court.
Well, and not only that, it's a place where, you know, Romney can speak and not have anybody heckle him. Right.
You know, no questions asked. I mean, no real questions.
He's on the eighth floor, you know, and on the roof of an eighth floor or seven or I don't know how many floors it is. Ours is six. Theirs is a little higher, so it's probably seven or eight floors. But there he was. So anyhow, Caleb, thanks a lot for the call. Well said. Michael in you're going to have to pronounce that, Michael in Washington State.
Washougal. Hi, Tom.
Oh,
thank
Washougal.
You.
Okay.
I think the Roberts pulled a Trojan horse.
Michael, you're breaking up really badly. You're fading in and out. Try it. No, I'm sorry, Michael. You're going to have to call back another time. I'm hearing every third word. Billy in Manhattan. Hey, Billy, what's up?
Hey, Tom. I was looking at something that said that there's $900 trillion. When I saw that, I had to shake my head. $900 trillion in derivatives on the world. And when I saw that the number has gotten so high, I wanted to investigate to see, you know, what was the source of this? And it led me to something in Switzerland called the Bank for International Settlements, which is kind of the head. My question is, this almost $quadrillion false swaps, which is almost like a coup d'etat in slow motion, transferring all the wealth to the rich. How the heck did that bank even come into being? I mean, where's the reporters of the world saying that the bankers are designing this global system to suck all the money to themselves? How did that even happen?
Well, it happened. It started in the United States, actually, in 1999 with the Commodity Futures Modernization Act. Phil Graham pushed that through Congress. The United States deregulated commodities and thus created the possibility of trading commodities on unregulated markets. It also, the Commodities Futures Modernization Act also allowed commodities to be defined not as the old-fashioned things. A commodity was something you could hold in your hand. It's gold, silver, pork bellies, wheat, corn, those kinds of things, soybeans, oil. But a commodity could be anything that derived its underlying value from a physical asset. So it could be mortgages on houses. It could be, you know, pretty much anything like that. And that's why they're called derivatives, because they derive their value from some underlying thing. And then you can bet against it. You can have a derivative against a derivative, because way down the chain, the derivative has some underlying value. Here in the United States, we goosed up a couple of $1 trillion worth of derivatives. Several other countries around the world, the UK being first among them, changed their rules to allow this sort of thing. Switzerland changed their rules to allow this sort of thing. It grew up to $900 trillion. You're correct on that number in 2007. And by mid-2008, and when the market crashed, that $900 trillion contracted down to around $600 or $700 trillion. Best guess. Nobody really knows for sure, but according to the Bank of International Settlements, and which doesn't settle all of them. They just settle some of them. And one of the reasons why this whole LIBOR thing, the London interbank overnight rate or something like that, that basically is the interest rate for the world. There's 65, this was in today's Financial Times. I was reading this article this morning on the train. $65 trillion worth of derivatives whose value is determined by an interest rate determined by the London Interbank Exchange Rate, the LIBOR, which Barclays Bank was just busted for manipulating, and they paid a little over $400 million in fines to avoid going to prison, having their executives go to prison. Now, I find it amazing that, you know, see, what they had figured out is if they could jack up the LIBOR interest rate, $65 trillion of the derivatives out there, you know, whose value is defined by that interest rate. So if they could jack that interest rate up 0.1% and be long on those derivatives, they could make hundreds of billions of dollars. And then they turn it around and go short on those derivatives and drop the interest rate by 0.1%, and they make another $100 billion. And this is the game that they were playing. It looks like there were U.S. banks involved as well as Barclays Bank. The investigation is going international. But what I find incredible is that Mr. Dimon, I'm not talking about Jamie Dimon, but Mr. Dimon, who is the head of Barclays Bank in the U.K., interesting coincidence, his bank lost 16% of their value yesterday, or early this morning, actually, when this came out hours ago in UK time, that they had been manipulating this LIBOR rate. And my apologies if I'm mispronouncing it. I'm not a wonk in the world of high finance. But this is just incredible. And this is another symptom of how banking needs to go back to being a nice, boring, reputable business rather than high-stakes gambling, where the wealth of the world is at stake. Coming up next, why we really need to be concerned rather than just sitting around smiling about yesterday's Supreme Court decision.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back. I want to explain why I think that those of us doing high fives on yesterday's Supreme Court ruling are making a big mistake. A big mistake. And I'm going to use abortion as an analogy here. And let me just, you know, for the record, start out by saying our abortion laws are a mess across this nation. We need to have a good national dialogue about when life begins. We need to have a good national dialogue about, you know, who plays what role in all of this. And for the purposes of this conversation, I'm going to remain relatively agnostic on that. I want to put this in a historical context, not a politically rhetorical context. But I'm going to use abortion because I think that yesterday's decision is this generation's Roe v. Wade. Now, if you think the Supreme Court's ruling that Obamacare is constitutional is the end of the debate on Obamacare, think again. This is one of those cases where history has a huge lesson to teach us. Back before 1973, abortion was illegal nationwide. I'm old enough to remember a girl in my high school in Lansing, Michigan, who in 1967 died of sepsis from an illegal abortion. One day she was there, the next week she was dead. Her dad worked at Oldsmobile. He had health insurance, but it didn't cover abortions because they were illegal. The rich girls had their parents get them a D&C operation in the hospital. Everybody in high school, we all knew that when a 17-year-old girl was out for a couple of days getting a D&C, that was code for an early-term abortion back when they were illegal. But this girl's parents didn't have the money to pay for a hospital procedure that wasn't covered by insurance. So she tried the coat hanger method and died. A lot of people who are old enough to remember pre-73 can tell you similar stories. Back in 1973, many, many Americans knew similar stories. For example, Supreme Court Justice in 1973, Lewis Powell, had a clerk. His clerk got his girlfriend pregnant. They were freaked out about it. The girlfriend tried to self-administer an abortion. She was bleeding. Her boyfriend, Lewis Powell's clerk, went to work for Lewis Powell that day, came back that night, and she was dead in his bedroom. She bled out from a botched self-administered abortion. This is a guy who worked for Supreme Court Justice Lewis Powell. At the time, he wasn't a Supreme Court Justice. This is when he was in his law practice in Virginia. So Powell called the local sheriff's office and basically used his political pull to help cover up the fact that this kid was involved in that, you know, that the abortion, I mean, technically this was manslaughter. And this kid ended up not having any consequence to him, and his girlfriend was dead. So Lewis Powell, who was on the court, was one of those many people who had some firsthand experience about this. This is why, when the Supreme Court struck down the nation's anti-abortion laws in 1973 in Roe v. Wade, at that point in 73, 52% of Americans agreed with the decision. So when Roe v. Wade was decided, Democrat, again, and again, this is not about abortion. And as I said, our abortion laws are a mess, and we need to have a national dialogue about abortion and about when life begins and all this other stuff. And everybody has been tiptoeing around it and afraid to talk about it, and it needs to happen, and it's not happening. And there are pro-life Democrats, and there are pro-choice Republicans, and it's just there needs to be a conversation. But all that said, when Roe v. Wade was decided in 1973, the Democrats figured that was the end of the issue. The Supreme Court had spoken. Democrats said, let's move ahead. Let's deal with the bigger issues like the environment or trade policy or ending the war in Vietnam, which, by the way, wasn't ended until 2 years later in 1975. Democrats figured that the controversy around Roe v. Wade would soon settle down because, after all, the Chief Justice Warren Burger, who had just been on the bench for 4 years, was a longtime conservative and Republican activist who'd helped Dwight Eisenhower win the White House. He had been appointed Chief Justice of the Supreme Court in 1969 by Richard Nixon, who'd been Eisenhower's vice president for 8 years and had known Burger for 2 decades. And Burger voted mostly in a conservative direction, for example, in 1972, the year before Roe v. Wade, albeit in the minority. He argued hard and voted to keep the death penalty legal in the United States. In fact, in his diary, in his notes, actually did a biography with BBC about 2 years before he died. And he said that was one of the things that he regretted, was that he had voted to keep the death penalty legal in the United States in 72. So anyhow, in 73, and then he actually voted to bring it back. It got bounced out in 72. It came back in, I think, 78, and he was the main force behind that. But in any case, in 73, Roe v. Wade came before the court, and conservative Nixon appointee Chief Justice Warren Burger, the John Roberts of his day, Republican conservative activist, appointed by Republican president just 4 years earlier, Chief Justice Warren Burger voted in a split decision, 7-2, that abortions during the first 3 months of pregnancy should become legal in the United States. Pundits and Republicans were shocked that the Nixon appointee for Chief Justice had just joined with the liberals on the bench. And there was all this huffing and puffing. But again, liberals figured, hey, it's a done deal. Let that be that. And what the liberals said and the Democrats during that time said, hey, live with it, right-wingers. And again, this isn't all liberals and all Democrats, because there are pro-life, anti-abortion liberals and Democrats. But you get the point here. I'm trying to draw a parallel that I think is a really important one, because immediately after that decision in 1973, conservative politicians started using their opposition or general opposition to the Supreme Court's decision in Roe and their opposition to abortion to make political hay and to raise huge piles of money. For over 100 years, the phrase right to life had described the anti-death penalty movement. It stretched back to just after the Civil War. But the National Right to Life Committee, incorporated in 1973 in response to Roe v. Wade. And today, pretty much nobody remembers that that phrase, right to life, used to refer to the movement to end the death penalty. Instead of going away, the whole controversy about Roe v. Wade, instead of going away like the Democrats thought it would, the newly birthed Right to Life movement to overturn the Supreme Court decision or to legislate around it grew into a powerful national force. It became the litmus test for Republican-appointed justices to the Supreme Court and even for federal appeals courts. Similarly, opposition to Roe v. Wade became the litmus test for Republican candidates for elective office. Pretty much the only strongly pro-choice Republican in the United States Senate right now, for example, is Olympia Snowe, and she's resigning this year. And most importantly, the anti-abortion forces have raised hundreds of billions of dollars for the Republican Party over the years. Which brings us to this week's Supreme Court decision upholding Obamacare. Democrats and the president are basking in the glow of winning a Supreme Court case. The president even made a statement encouraging us all not to all to move on from the debate, right? Remember that? Let's move on. Don't relitigate the past. Instead, let's focus on bringing jobs back to America. Progressives are sitting around going, ah, sigh of relief. We've got that health care thing under control. I'm telling you, this issue is not over. Mark my words, this is the beginning of a generational battle. And here's why. There's no such thing as a perfect health care system. Obamacare isn't either. There will be people who will get bad care. There will be people who die from mistakes in the system. And the Republicans will make them as iconic and famous as Terry Schiavo. Every little failure or problem will be magnified a hundredfold. Repeal Obamacare is going to be the battle cry for Republicans for the next 20 years or longer. You think not? It's already started. Michelle Bachmann was on CNN this morning encouraging governors to refuse to implement the state insurance exchanges. Scott Walker's already said he's not going to go along with Obamacare. The former head of the Michigan Republicans, in a candid moment that he later walked back, wondered out loud if it was time for an armed insurrection. Mitt Romney raised $3 million in just a couple of hours after the decision came down yesterday. Groups are forming all over the country to fight Obamacare. Democrats, wake up! This is going to be massive.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
And just like with abortion, the Republicans will never make a real and serious effort to do away with Obamacare because they know doing away with it would horrify most Americans, and then they can't raise money on it anymore. Welcome back. Okay, this is the point that I've been making is that in 1954, it was Brown versus Board of Education. You must integrate your schools. And from the 1954 in well through the mid-60s into the 70s, right-wingers raised money based on Brown versus Board of Education and this rallying cry of impeach Earl Warren. Then after 1973, they shifted to Roe v. Wade. And, you know, not exclusively right-wingers, but this has become a cause for the right that's obligatory. It's the litmus test for Republicans. It's not to say there aren't pro-life Democrats. There are. And I'm telling you, Obamacare is going to replace Roe v. Wade. It's going to become the new litmus test for the Republican Party. Year after year, these Republicans are going to be waving the bloody shirt of their opposition to Obamacare. And just like with abortion, this is going to flip elections from city councils to Congress to the White House. So get ready. The storm has just begun. I'm telling you, this is serious. I've got a piece here somewhere. My pile of stuff that I saw today on, maybe I don't have it anymore. Here it is, right here. It's on Alternet. The 10 most hilariously unhinged white right-wing reactions to the Obamacare ruling. This is what I'm warning you about. Calling these hilarious. These people are dead serious. And the people who follow them, who listen to them on right-wing talk radio, who watch them on Fox News, who read them on the right-wing websites, they're dead serious. So here, you know, Joshua Holland, who I have a world of respect for, has compiled 10 incredibly, well, unhinged right-wing reactions. But I beg to differ that they're hilarious. These things are a sign of the storm that is coming. Breitbart editor Ben Shapiro tweets out, this is the greatest destruction of individual liberty since Dred Scott. This is the end of America as we know it. No exaggeration. You know, Sarah Palin said American democracy is dying. Conservatives, are, you know, one of them that Joshua found says, I'm moving to Canada. That's it. Screw this. I'm moving to Canada. Jump off a cliff, Obama. Moving to Canada, really? Did you know that they already have universal health care and gay marriage there? Number three in Joshua Holland's list over at Alternet, Mike Pence, linking, saying this is like 9/11. Well, no, it's not. But see, he thinks it is. The former Michigan Republican Party spokesman Matthew Davis, he sent out an email saying, is armed rebellion now justified? And then he sent out another one, a personal note saying, here's my response, and yes, I mean it. Matthew Vadim, who's been on this show, he said, we don't just need a new president, we need a revolution. Richard Viguerie, who's been on this show, stalwart of the conservative movement since Goldwater days, as Joshua writes, says, you know, a 5-4 majority of the Supreme Court, the body of the framers of the Constitution created to protect the citizens from tyranny, has chosen to join infamous courts of the past, such as the Taney Court that made Dred Scott, the Dred Scott v. Sanford decision, finding that slaves had no rights, and the Fuller Court that ruled to institutionalize Jim Crow discrimination in Plessy v. Ferguson in stripping Americans of their freedom. By the way, John Roberts, I've heard from news reports, I can't vouch for this as being absolutely true, but it looks like he's taking a summer gig in Malta as a visiting professor. I don't know. We'll see. Malta is this really cool little island state where everybody knows everybody, and it's pretty laid back and very expensive. Glenn Beck is hysterical about it. He's saying progressives are fascists. John Roberts, a traitor, is, you know, Seton Motley, who's been on this show. Dean Clancy has been on the show, the Tea Party and Freedom Works. I have a message for Chief Justice Roberts. The power to tax is the power to destroy. Brian Fisher, who's been on this show, says Roberts is going down in history as the justice that shredded the Constitution and turned into a worthless piece of parchment. And then here's another one. This, just a typical comment. Someone got to Roberts. I bet they got to him and told him that he has to vote this way or members of his family, wife, kids, parents, whatever, are going to be killed. Right. I'm telling you, do not laugh at these people. A year from now, 2 years from now, 3 years from now, if you're running for office as a Republican, you're going to have to swear on a stack of Bibles that you will do everything in your power to roll back Obamacare. It will not be rolled back. The Republicans won't even make a serious effort to roll it back. They'll make symbolic efforts, just like they've been doing about abortion since 1973. But if they actually rolled it back, they'd lose their issue. They're not going to roll it back. It's just like after 1954, after Brown versus Board of Education, and after the Civil Rights Act. I mean, you've got Republicans now who are talking about, let's not renew the Civil Rights Act. Right. They're not actually going to do it, but they're going to raise a pile of money on it, and this is going to be a big deal. This is going to be a huge big deal. And the only way to counter this is to point out to people how and why the Affordable Care Act is good, is useful, that it is covering people, that it is not, as Mitt Romney said yesterday, a $500 billion cut in Medicare. It is not at all. It is a zero cut in Medicare. It is not a tax increase if you want to sell your house, unless you happen to make over $250,000 last year in the stock market. And even then, it's just, you know, it's a small tax that you pay on top of your 15% maximum tax rate.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
We need to be knocking down the lies and telling people what Obamacare does, which I will do after this break, and then I'll be picking up your calls. We're going to go back to Anything Goes Friday, but I had to get this on the record. Okay, just a very, very quick overview of the key features of the Affordable Care Act. It's starting in 2010. They put information online. You can find this at healthcare.gov. Got any questions? Go to healthcare.gov. Again, starting in 2010, they prohibit insurance companies from denying coverage to children based on pre-existing conditions. They prohibit insurance companies from rescinding coverage. In other words, killing your health insurance policy because you got sick. Yes, insurance companies used to routinely do that. It's against the law now. Now. In fact, it has been for a year and a half. They eliminated lifetime limits on insurance coverage. That has been in place since September of 2010. No more lifetime limits. They regulate annual limits on insurance coverage. And starting in 2014, there will be no limits. But the health, this began effective for health plans beginning September 23rd, 2010. Starting in 2010, you can appeal your insurance company decisions, and they actually have to hear your appeal. Wouldn't you like it if your bank had to do that? I would like to appeal my mortgage. No, we're not going to talk to you. That's how health insurance companies have dealt with us. No, sorry. That's it. Now you can appeal. And they've established consumer assistance programs in the states. They provide, this is still 2010, small business health insurance tax credits. Up to 4 million businesses are eligible. Credit is worth up to 35% of the employer's contribution to the person's health care. Nonprofits, 25%. They're offering relief for 4 million seniors who hit the donut hole. They're going to get a one-time tax-free $250 rebate check. That was in 2010. It's getting better now. Free preventative care, free mammograms, free colonoscopies. No charge, no deductible, no copay, no coinsurance. Started in 2010. $15 billion prevention and public health fund. Started in 2010 to prevent illness and disease. Cracking down on health care fraud. They set aside $2.5 billion to find fraud. And save a whole lot more than $2.5 billion. Providing access to insurance for uninsured Americans with pre-existing conditions. They've got this pre-existing insurance plan. Now, you have to be out of insurance for 6 months to get into it. After 2014, you won't have to wait, but right now you got to wait 6 months. That started in 2010. Extending coverage to young adults. You can put your kids on your policy, or if you're under 26, you could be on your parents' policy. That, again, started in 2010. Expanding coverage for early retirees. Is a $5 billion program. If you are between 55 and 65 and you want to retire, they will provide coverage to you. This is applications are available to via your employer. You need to talk to them about that. But again, you want the information, go to healthcare.gov. Holding insurance companies accountable for unreasonable rate hikes. Allowing states to cover more people on Medicaid. Increasing payments for rural health care providers. 68% of medically underserved people live in rural communities. Strengthening community health centers. This was Bernie's thing. 10,000 new community health centers in the United States. One of my kids worked at one of them, and they're amazing. Offering prescription drug discounts. 50% discount. This is now we're to 2011. 50% discount when buying Medicare Part D brand name drugs. Providing free preventative care to seniors. Again, started January 1st, 2011. Providing care to seniors after they leave the hospital. It'll come to your home and take care of you. This started last year. Bringing down health care premiums. I mean, it just goes on and on. And this is just up to last year. This year, 2012, linking payment to quality outcomes, encouraging integrated health care systems, reducing paperwork and administrative costs, increasing access. It just... You know, and then in 2014, the really big stuff, prohibiting discrimination due to pre-existing conditions or gender. No more annual limits, period. If you want to get into a clinical trial, if there's an experimental drug and your last stage cancer, so they will cover it. Making care more affordable. If your income is between 100 and 400% of the poverty line. That means if you make up to $88,000 for a family of four, you qualify for this stuff. Establishing affordable insurance exchanges. This is what the states are doing. And if the state doesn't do it, the federal government will come in and do it for them. So even though Scott Walker says he ain't going to do it, it'll get done. Increasing access to Medicaid. And I mean, it goes on and on. It's like, as I said, healthcare.gov. We have to sell this. You have to know what's in this, and you have to tell people, because if you don't, when the polling is done right now, and the Republicans know this, and they're carrying this into November, when you ask people, do you support Obamacare? Most Americans say no. Why? Because there has been tens of millions, perhaps hundreds of millions of dollars in ads run so far talking about how Obamacare is this terrible thing. You see that woman in the doctor's outfit? She looks like, I think either she's a doctor or a physician assistant or whatever it is. And she says, oh, we don't, you know, this is bad, bad stuff. Right? These ads are working. But on the other hand, if you ask people, should insurance companies be able to cut you off just because you got sick? No, of course not. Should they be required to take you even if you have a pre-existing condition? Well, of course. When people hear the details, they like Obamacare. We have to tell them the details. Because if we don't, this is going to be Roe v. Wade for another two generations. This is going to be the bloody shirt that the Republicans, to use a French Revolution metaphor, that the Republicans are waving around for the next 20, 30 years. Roll back Obamacare. And it will work for them. John in Bernard, Kansas. Hey, John, what's up?
Yeah, hey, Tom. Well, I've had other rants, but I'm just going to cut them short. And I have a quick one. I came up with a thought that the right wing are moving so far to the right, I'm beginning to think they're moving into a parallel dimension.
Yeah.
And they're just in another reality, because watching their reaction yesterday, it was like watching people reacting to something unreal. And I come to the conclusion that they're in a parallel dimension, and they're just not in a real world anymore.
You're absolutely right. John, thank you for the call, and thanks for pointing that out. And here's what's going on. There are actual lies being disseminated on the right, and a lot of people are on these email lists. In fact, tens of millions, if not hundreds of millions of Americans get these emails that say, did you know under Obamacare you're going to get taxed if you sell your house? No, sorry, not true. Did you know under Obamacare, that Obamacare is a $1.7 trillion tax increase? No, not true. Did you know that Obamacare is going to cut half a trillion, $500 billion out of Medicare? No, not true. Right? Mitt Romney's saying these things, and they're not true. And we have to be pushing back on this stuff. Anyway, DiCarlo in Oakland, California. Hey, DiCarlo, what's up?
Hey, how are you doing, Tom? I was just calling in to say one thing. Since you were talking about the situation with women and the Roe v. Wade situation again, I think you should maybe try and suggest to people, again, with your talking about health care, but talk to them instead about pro-life, tell them to say pro-birth, because what's happened is that they've primarily taken this over, yeah. And they use...
DiCarlo, I was using Roe v. Wade as an example of one case. I don't want to turn this into a debate about abortion. I'm not going to go. We could do an entire hour, an entire day on it, but it is too large and complex an issue. It is not that simple. It's too large and too complex an issue to just be flippant about. My point was that Roe v. that was a Supreme Court decision where the Chief Justice, 4 years on the bench, put there by a conservative, and he ruled with the liberals. And it freaked out the conservatives to the point that it has become the litmus test issue for the Republican Party. And I'm telling you, this is going to be the same. If we don't get ahead of this, and if the Obama administration doesn't get ahead of this, very, very quickly. Trudeau in Ishpeming, Michigan. Hey, Trudeau, what's up?
Not too much. Yesterday, I almost fell off the chair when he... I thought, oh, boy, my heart sank at the first part of it. But, I agree with you 100%. But, some of the people that really need this stuff don't even have a computer. And, if the Democrats lose this election, they deserve to. And the reason being is that where all the stuff that I get in the mail, people are interested in what is it going to do. The Republicans are doing a beautiful job right now. For those who don't have jobs and everything else, they're threatening and everything else. Let's see some stuff on paper.
Yeah.
If you are in this category, this is what you pay. If you pay over this, you're paying too much. We need to see something, not a shot in the dark.
Yeah. No, I absolutely agree with you. And if Obamacare is a government program, and it is to a large extent, I mean, it's using for-profit health insurance companies, cringe, but nonetheless, there it is, then let's do like George W. Bush did, you know, when he took Bernie Sanders' suggestion that everybody in America get a $300 tax rebate after 9/11 to boost the economy. And he sent those checks out with a note that said, this is basically a gift to you from George W. Bush. Let's mail out information to people.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
It's not enough to just put it online at healthcare.gov. You've got to, as Bush said, catapult the propaganda.
Ain't that good news? Man, ain't that news? Ain't that news? Ain't that good news, man?
We will be back with more of your calls for Anything Goes Friday here right after the break. And there's Obamacare myths, fracking, desalination plants, Daryl Issa, Romney's mansion, Keystone-related oil spills, NLRB, voter suppression. A lot of topics stacked up here that I'm really eager to get into. We'll do that right after the break at the top of the hour. But first, this talk radio news service brought to you by the German Embassy, who wants you to know that Germany supports the European strategy to strengthen the euro through fiscal stability, solidarity, and growth. Learn more online at germany.info. Victoria Jones with the talk radio news service on the line with us. Victoria, what's up in the world today?
Well, Tom, the Justice Department says it's not going to prosecute Attorney General Eric Holder for contempt of Congress.
I am shocked.
Yes.
Shocked.
They wrote a letter this afternoon to House Speaker Boehner, or today anyway, saying that his decision to withhold information about Fast and Furious, it doesn't constitute a crime, so he won't be prosecuted. And in a letter to John Boehner, the Speaker, they say they won't bring the citation to a federal grand jury and that they're not going to take any other action to prosecute him.
Right. This was a clown vote, bro.
I think that's what
or you know, sis.
People who walked out.
Wasn't it Harry Reid the other day who said that's a clown vote, bro? this is a clown vote.
It's a clown vote, bro, and that's going into the annals, indeed.
Yeah.
President Obama today visited the Colorado wildfires. He went to Colorado Springs, Colorado, and toured areas ravaged by fires. And then he met with firefighters, he met with people from federal, state, and local agencies, he met with people who had been harmed by the fires, I mean, in terms of losing homes and things like that. And then he said that when natural disasters like this hit, America comes together. He said he saw enormous devastation, but that authorities are also starting to see progress. And he also said something interesting towards the end of his remarks. He talked about that we can provide all the resources, but that, as he told the firefighters, that what we cannot do is provide them with the courage, the determination, the professionalism, and the heart they show when they're out there battling these fires. And then towards the very end, he seemed to me to be giving a bit of a shout-out for either rehiring or for not firing firefighters. I may have been reading something into it. He said, and so for folks all around the country, I hope you're reminded of how important our fire departments are, our forest services. Sometimes they don't get the credit they deserve until your house is burning down or community is being threatened. And you have to understand they're putting their lives at risk to help us and save us. We've got to make sure that we remember that 365 days a year, not just when tragedies like this strike.
I think he was speaking back to Mitt Romney saying, don't the Democrats get it that the message of 2010 was we don't want any more firefighters, police, and teachers?
That's what I thought he was saying, too.
Yeah.
That's exactly what I thought he was saying. Congress has passed a bill. That's
really?
News.
That is
the news.
This is the one Bernie told us about today, the transportation bill?
This is the transportation bill, which piggybacks on it student loans staying at 33.4% interest, not going up to 6.8% interest, which it would do on Sunday, and the transportation bill would run out of money tomorrow.
Right.
And National Flood Insurance Program, which would run out of money in a month. So they're all going through. They've all gone through. They're going to the president's desk.
There is one gotcha that the Democrats in the Senate did not put in the student loan bill that the Republicans in the House insisted on being in the student loan bill, and that is that right now, if you have a student loan and you graduate from college, you have 6 months or 6 month grace period before you have to start paying down your student loan or before you're even charged interest. That 6 months becomes zero under this new legislation, thanks to the Republicans in the House of Representatives.
There were compromises. There were pieces in all the in both the student loans and in transportation that both sides didn't like.
Yeah.
There were pieces. There were Republicans who didn't want the student loans to go through at all.
Yeah, of course. An educated populace? Are you kidding? We don't need that.
Oh, you're talking about Texas.
Yes.
Yeah. Well, it's believed it will salvage maybe as many as 2.8 million jobs.
Yes. Well, that's good. That's good.
Highly significant.
Yes.
Highly significant. In Syria, many killed in very fierce shelling of Damascus suburbs where the rebels are operating. Also, tomorrow, world powers meeting in Geneva for talks on Syria.
Mm-hmm.
They don't expect a breakthrough because Russia is not going to endorse a call on Bashar al-Assad to give up power, which the others would like to have. And Secretary of State Hillary Clinton, it says, it's very clear that all the participants are on board with a transition plan created by International Envoy Kofi Annan, but that is not going to happen. Saving healthcare for last, because most people are probably healthcared out.
Mm-hmm.
People are trying to figure out at this point what it means, who's going to be most galvanized going into the election. There, frankly, isn't any actual healthcare news.
Yeah, well, I'll give you an opinion. I've been ranting about this for the last hour. I think that this is going to be dealt with the way that Roe v. Wade was. I think that there's going to be an entire movement that comes about to repeal Obamacare. It's going to be a generational movement. That is, it's going to last, you know, 10, 20 years or longer. And as long as Obamacare exists, people will find things wrong with it. I mean, you know, people in England sit around and complain about the National Health Service. Then you say to them, well, you want to do away with it? Oh, no. but I don't like how that lady treated me last week when I went into the surgery. And, I mean, you know, they will find some person who fell through the cracks of Obamacare and turn that person into Terry Schiavo. My prediction is that this is going to be a huge deal. And it's going to tremendously help the Republicans and Democrats who think that they won a victory yesterday. I mean, arguably the American people won a victory, but I don't think the Democrats did. I think they're going to be hit with a 2x4 and they're not ready for it.
I agree.
Thank you. Victoria Jones of the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com, brought to you by the German Embassy. Thank you, Victoria.
Thank you.
Which wants you to know that Germany supports the European strategy to strengthen the euro through fiscal stability, solidarity, and growth. You can learn more at germany.info. We'll be back with more about this whole gestalt.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Well, it's being reported, although I don't believe it, that Donald Trump has announced that John Roberts' birth certificate is fake. It's all over the web. I mean, it's got to be Andy Borowitz started this thing, right? You know, there's John Hussein Roberts. Yes. Okay, I was taking a cab a couple days ago. I want to share this with you. And then we'll get back to your calls here, and anything goes Friday. I was taking a cab a couple of days ago, and this cab driver picks me up, and he's got this actually a very beautiful accent. And it was one that was familiar to me, but I couldn't place. I wasn't sure, you know, it almost sounded like he was from Kenya, but not. Actually, it didn't sound like he was from Kenya. In any case, so I said, "What's your accent?" And he said, I'm from Ghana. And I was like, oh, that's great. I'm on the air in Ghana. You know, our Pacifica Radio syndicates our program, and Radio Bulisa, carries our show to about a third of the country of Ghana. I was like, oh, that's really cool. And then he went, he just went off. This was right after the healthcare decision. I guess it must have been, yeah, it was yesterday afternoon. And he goes off on this healthcare thing. He says, I don't understand. He said, when I was growing up in Ghana, we didn't have healthcare. And it was terrible. And then a couple of years ago, they passed this healthcare for everybody in the country, and anybody can go to the doctor now. And he said, it's like night and day. It's a wonderful thing. Why don't you Americans want this? And I'm like, well, you know, it's so. Anyhow, there is a lot of speculation on the Reich about why John Roberts voted and actually went through some legal contortions to establish this tax concept for Obamacare, to pass Obamacare. And I know Michael Savage is saying, and I think this is jumping the shark, I think this is way over the top, is saying that because John Roberts has epilepsy, he takes meds for the epilepsy, and those medications have clouded his brain. But I think half of what Michael Savage, also known as Michael Wiener, his real name, I think half of what Michael Wiener is saying is actually right. And I think it might have to do with why John Roberts went to all this trouble to make sure that Obamacare didn't get knocked down. Because here's a guy who's in his 50s, who, as I recall, when he was a teenager, started having seizures. He's had epilepsy most of his life. He probably has been turned down for health insurance. And if he hasn't been turned down, he has certainly seen, you know, the face of that. He's got a pre-existing condition, and a big one. One that arguably has rendered him uninsurable. So perhaps more than anyone else on that court, John Roberts is in a position to understand how important it is that we have a national healthcare system that says everybody in, nobody out. And now on the right, you know, they're calling him traitor and betrayer and coward. That Glenn Beck is selling a T-shirt that says, you know, it's got a picture of John Roberts. It says coward underneath it. I think that it's possible. You know, we were really struggling with this yesterday. Why did John Roberts do this? Other than that it's the right thing to do. I mean, that's the easy answer. Well, it was obviously it was the right thing to do. You know, the law made sense. Maybe. But this court is so political that the law making sense really rarely has anything to do with it. And I think it might be because having lived with epilepsy for much of his life, John Roberts understands what a pre-existing condition is. Maybe. But anyhow, let me just, it's anything goes Friday, so I'm going to throw this open to you. Any topic you want to talk about. Fletcher in Tampa, Florida. Hey, Fletcher, what's up?
Hey. I've got exactly the reason why Roberts did what he did. It's not epilepsy or anything like that. They're not stupid on the right. And if he was to knock this down, the left would be energized right before an election.
Yes.
Keeping it in, the right is now energized, and you can see how much the right is energized.
Yeah, he did give a great gift to the Republican Party. There's
yeah,
that too. I mean, that was
a huge rallying cry for him.
Yes.
And the reason he did it the way he did it is if he would have done it with the Commerce Cause, people would look at that and say, "Oh, can Republicans overturn this?" Well, no. It would be extremely hard to overturn it. There's no way they can overturn it.
Right. But doing it as a tax, plays right into the Frank Luntz talking points.
Yes, it's easier to overturn it. They don't need a supermajority; they just need a majority.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. There's that too.
Easier.
Yes.
So, and it plays right in the Republicans. Say, all we need to do is get the majority. We just need a few more wins.
That's right. Revenue bills can't be filibustered.
Yeah.
Wow. So I hadn't considered
this is
that.
Why he did. And they're not dumb on there.
Yeah.
And this was purposely done in order to energize the right.
Yeah.
Because Romney wasn't energizing the right. So this energized them.
You know, that makes a lot
this
of sense.
Is gonna make the, this is going to make the election very, very close.
Yeah, well, I've been saying that all along. In fact, you know, I've spent the better part of the last hour saying that this is going to be the new club that Republicans use to beat up Democrats, and that they use to beat up other Republicans for not being ideologically pure. Fletcher, excellent point. Thank you for calling and making it. John in San Diego. Hey, John.
Hey, Tom. Just a point of irony here. I grew up in the early 50s, and I'm 66, and a school teacher, public school teacher, a history teacher, as a matter of fact. And I grew up in La Jolla in a house that's right next door to Cliff Robertson's mansion on the beach. Well, guess who owns that mansion now? Talk about irony.
Would that be Mitt Romney?
That would be Mitt Romney.
Oh, this is the one where he hired a lobbyist to lobby the city so that he could put in an elevator for his wife's Cadillac?
Yeah, and I no longer live there. I live a little bit south from there. But nonetheless, the irony is unbelievable because Cliff Robertson, I'm sure as you know, was persecuted by the House of for being too far to the left. And
I didn't know that. Cliff Robertson was accused of being a communist by who act? By the House Un-American Activities Committee?
Blackballed. And as a matter of fact, and so the irony is, of course, now Mitch Romney is the Mitt Romney has that house. So that's a little bit of a bit of irony there.
Yeah.
The question I wanted to ask is, I got the impressions, however, that the insurance companies aren't totally against this bill so much. I mean, don't they stand to gain from some of the...
They do. What they want is a repeal and replace. They want all of the stuff that is very popular in there. They don't have a problem with that, and they want everybody in. They love that. What they don't like, and this, I think, is why they want the repeal and replace, what they don't like is that starting in 4 years, individual states can kick all of the insurance companies out and do their own single-payer systems. And that will be the death of the insurance industry, and they know it.
Well, they want to avoid that. But yet they seem very sort of complacent about it when I watch even MSNBC and so on, some of the representatives. Where are the Democrats? Why aren't they speaking up? Why are we hearing more about Republican response than Democratic? This is an advertising problem I think the Democrats have to get down and understand. It's not simply about money. It's about something else, and I can't quite put my finger on it.
Yeah, I think it's about outrage at the end of the day, about energizing the base and about getting people out to vote. And this is going to help the Republicans tremendously. John, thank you for the call.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
It's also going to help the American people tremendously. And that's kind of a sad commentary, that blowing up something that helps the American people is going to help the Republicans. Linda in Lomberg, North Carolina, welcome to the program. What's on your mind today?
Hi, Tom. I have never heard why toxic chemicals have to be used in fracking.
Well, I'm sorry.
Oh, is it to get rid of all their toxic chemicals, or why can't they just use water with all the pressure?
Well, they're actually getting rid of toxic chemicals in a cheap way is one of the side effects that has been proposed as one of the major reasons why some of the chemicals are in there and why the formulas are proprietary, which is an exemption to the EPA laws that Dick Cheney personally pushed through in the last years of the Bush administration. And so, you know, the oil companies and refineries and chemical industry and whatnot, they end up with chemicals that cost them thousands of dollars a pound to dispose of safely in incinerators and you know, using enzymes or however they do it, for depending on the chemical. And now they can simply give it to the fracking companies and say, pump it into the ground. And this can be done legally because of this exemption that Dick Cheney gave. But generally speaking, the chemicals that they use have to have lubricant qualities and principally lubricant qualities that they they break up the rock and under the pressure, and then they lubricate those brakes. So you've got a lot of petroleum byproducts in there, and I'm guessing that a lot of them are really, really nasty chemicals. And the fact of the matter is that most of these lubricants are toxic. It's not that they go out looking for toxic chemicals and say, let's put these in the ground. Although in some cases, as I said, that may be the case because it saves the money. But it's more that most of the lubricating chemicals, you know, are toxic. It's just like, you know, the stuff that lubricates your car, your motor oil. You drink that, you will die. It is toxic. And but it's necessary as a lubricant. So
water wouldn't work?
No. To the best of my understanding, it would not. It's not enough. But, you know, I'm not an expert on fracking, but from the people who are experts on fracking that I've heard, water will work to a certain extent, but it doesn't work anywhere near as well as the water plus these chemicals. Linda, thank you for the call, and thanks for watching. Patricia, watching us on Roku. Yeah, I think you're the first caller I've gotten. Louise and I have Roku, and it is so cool. And
yeah, it is cool. Tom, it is written, we the people. And I want to start a rant, and I hope you join in, that we are not the folks. There's folk dancing, folklore, folk music, but I think that the folk in all of us is a dumbing down process so that we, the folk, don't understand what's really going on. And I think we deserve the dignity of being called people.
Yeah, somebody went off on a rant about this a week or so ago. Was it Bill Maher?
I've been trying to get in for a week because every time I hear it, especially coming out of the mouth of the president, I just become incensed.
Does the president refer to the folk of America?
Yeah.
Oh my. Well, it's apparently the contemporary vernacular and unfortunate. I agree with you. I would much rather be we the people than we the folk.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I think it is a dumbing down process, which is most of what we have to be against.
Yeah, I'm totally with you. Patricia, thank you. Or excuse me.
Patricia?
Yeah, Patricia. Yeah, Patricia, thank you very much for calling.
Okay.
I appreciate
thanks.
It. Yeah, you're welcome. John in Minneapolis. Hey, John.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. Sure. I just wanted to bring to the attention, if people are trying to unionize, how difficult it is. You know, over the years, under several Republican administrations, they've made it very, very difficult. Under the National Labor Relations Board, they've pretty much scammed the rules in favor of management and preventing unionization. And there's very little protection, really, when it comes down to it, for people who are trying to unionize. They will go after you with a vengeance, and you really have very little protection.
Yeah.
And this is because, you know, as you said before, in other countries they have labor as part of the board of a corporation or a nonprofit organization. And it's just sad because, you know, that's the very basis upon which democracy really is built, you know, especially within the workplace, as you have said, and I absolutely agree. It's just, you know, it's very difficult for ordinary working people to organize and to protect themselves, and then on top of it, you know, we have a movement to right to work, which would just undermine the whole process.
Right to work for less. Let's use the right phrase. You're absolutely right, John. And the weakening of the NLRB started under Nixon in a small way, and then Reagan put it on steroids. Reagan was the first president in the history of the United States to appoint to the National Labor Relations Board a man, or to the Labor Department, to head up the Labor Department, a man who was openly hostile to labor. And you know, that has been the motif of every Republican president since then. And it's a tragedy. We've gone from almost a third of America being unionized when Reagan came into office to now, you know, less than a twelfth, would it be? You know, 7%.
Yeah.
You know, it's a tragedy. So
it really is. I just wanted to say one more thing that actually this is William Grider, who wrote for the Washington Post and describes himself as a labor writer. Said that he had heard from people in the Bush administration, George Bush, you know, the son, that, you know, they wanted to actually take this country back to to the Gilded Age, you know, of, you know, pre-union movements,
yep,
of the Triangle Shirtwaist Factory Fire type of working conditions.
Yep.
And they think that's just wonderful. And, you know, I don't understand why it is that there just isn't an uproar. I come from a union background. I had ancestors who were in that fire and died.
Wow.
You know, people, this history needs to be brought forth. I don't know how we can do it, but, you know, we need to bring this to the attention of people that this is exactly what they want to do. They want to turn it back.
Agreed, John. Agreed. And the reason there isn't an outroar is because the pot has been turned up slowly.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
Where the heat on the pot has been turned up slowly. It's the old frog boiling in the water story, and people are just all of a sudden looking around going, what? Where'd everything go? Talk media for the sane among us. Welcome back to the Tom Hartman Program. And Brian in Cumberland, Maryland. Hey, Brian, what's on your mind today?
Hi, Tom. How are you? My son and I enjoy your show, and
thank you.
It's really bothering me that there's all this propaganda being spun for Obamacare. My wife works for an insurance company, and one of the ladies there told her that they're going to start taking money out of her paycheck when she cashes her check at the bank to fund Obamacare. And I was kind of hoping maybe you could put some information out so everybody will know where to go look at the plan, that they can read what it really is.
Yeah, the website is healthcare.gov. It's all laid out there in excruciating detail and also in a fairly decent summary form. It is the website that was funded by the Affordable Care Act to inform people about it, healthcare.gov. And you could assure your wife's friend that when she cashes her checks, nobody's going to be taking money out of them. So it's just, you know, the lies that are being spread just blow my mind. Brian, thank you very much for the call. Marco in Calgary, Alberta. Hey, Marco. Alberta. Hey, Marco, what's up?
Oh, how's it going? I'm a big fan, longtime listener.
Thank you.
I was actually born and raised in Texas. I'm a big lefty. I come from a long line of Texas Democrats. And,
oh, great.
But I live up here in Calgary, Alberta now. And been following this whole Keystone thing. You know, I like most of us here, I do work in the oil and gas sector, but, you know, I'm not a supporter of big oil, so I find myself, you know, arguing with people all the time. And,
yeah.
You know, I'm kind of surrounded here, but I just want to let you know, we just recently had an oil spill here of a pipeline underneath one of our rivers, the Red Deer River. It's a pretty good-sized river that feeds into a big reservoir that a lot of towns depend on and farming communities. And it wasn't much of a spill, you know, 300 barrels. You know, I guess, I mean, that's, you know, still a lot of oil. But it contaminated the reservoir. They weren't allowed to drink, irrigate, you know, swim, fish.
I don't know.
So it really upset a lot of people in the area, and it just didn't seem like it was getting much coverage down in the States, you know. And
it's getting no coverage down in the States.
And I was hoping, you know, maybe you could investigate a little more, maybe, you know, do a little bit on your show about it, because I think that's something people need to be aware of, because it doesn't take much, you know, to render vast areas just suddenly uninhabitable. You know, if you pollute your water, that's it. You're screwed.
Yep. What's the name of the river again?
The Red Deer River.
Spell it.
Feeding into the Glenifer Reservoir.
Could you spell that river for me?
But R-E-D, red, and D-R, D-E-E-R.
Oh, okay, Red Deer. Okay, got it.
Yeah, and I was just thinking, you know, it happened between Calgary and Edmonton, but if it was a bit bigger spill and it went into one of the rivers that feeds, you know, Calgary's or Edmonton's reservoirs, you know, we're over a million each, you know, that would be devastating, you know. It would just basically ruin us, and that's what a lot of people don't seem to realize. You know, are you willing to sacrifice, you know, your whole economy, your whole environment, you know, for short-term jobs? And
yeah,
and I can tell, you know, these pipeline jobs are short and fast. You know, I a long time ago used to survey, and I surveyed pipeline, and you're in and out of some of these towns in a matter of weeks.
Yeah,
you know, and you're gone.
Well, and that's the, you know, the Republicans are saying, the Keystone Pipeline, it'll create 6,000 jobs. Yeah, for a year.
No, and I've been doing a lot of work down in Pennsylvania here recently, and I can tell you, when I go down there, all the trucks, all the crews are from places like Texas, Louisiana, Alberta. Mm. You know, the local people just don't have the experience to work on these crews, so they bring in out of state. So don't think you're going to be getting all these wonderful high-paying jobs all of a sudden.
That makes a lot of sense, too. Marco, thanks for the call, and thanks for enlightening our listeners and viewers. Scott in McVeightown, Pennsylvania. Hey, Scott, what's up?
Hey, Tom, can you hear me good?
I do.
Okay, I have a little bit of an idea here. I swear to God I'm not a Republican. Just bear with me here a minute.
Okay.
Okay.
Even if you are, you're welcome to call.
Right, but I have a little bit more sense than that. But anyway, okay, we all know the glaciers are melting. You know, oceans are becoming less salty.
Mm-hmm.
So we should build solar and wind-powered desalination plants, you know, to remove the salt from the water, okay? If you did that in Mexico on both coasts, I think that the United States government would see an outflux of undocumented workers, probably a lot of American documented workers, flooding to Mexico, because you could use that water to drip irrigate half of Mexico, grow half the world's vegetation for vegetables in Mexico by the Mexican people, you know, not corporate Mexican, okay? These people came here to work, so, you know, They know how to farm, so
some of the countries in the Middle East are massively using desalination now to take water out of the Straits of Hormuz and convert it into drinking water. But it is really energy intensive. This is a technology that is awaiting another massive technological breakthrough, and because it just takes so much. I mean, where are you going to get the energy to drive it? I suppose in Mexico you got a lot of solar power.
Well, you have a lot of wind power everywhere on planet Earth. You know, somewhere there's somebody who, you know, has the ability, the money, startup capital or whatever, to maybe make that, you know, you have to start somewhere. You can't move a mountain unless you start moving small stones, right?
Yep.
So, I mean, if you take the salt out of the water, keep the fresh water, refill our aquifers, build, you know, put people to work building, you know, reservoirs to hold fresh water, put the salt back in the sea. The net is less fresh water sea, okay? But, like I said, you have to start somewhere. I mean, you know, the point is this, you know, the Native Americans said, you know, we didn't inherit this planet from our grandparents. We're borrowing it from our grandchildren.
Yep.
So we ought to sit down and talk about how to make the world better for our grandchildren.
Yes. Yeah.
You know, the ancient Chinese said that if we don't change the path we're on, you know, we're likely to wind up just where we're headed. So I just kind of wondered, you know, what you thought about all that. And have a good day, Tom. I love what you're doing there. Keep it up.
Thank you very much, Scott. I think, you know, I think you've made a very important point, and it's one that needs to be amplified. Paul in Benton Harbor, Michigan. Hey, Paul, what's up?
Tom, it's Raul, but that's okay.
Raul,
Tom,
I'm sorry.
You're always singing the praises of Ike and his domestic policies, especially...
Well,
like
I can give you a long list of things Ike did wrong, too. I'm selective in what I like about Ike.
Okay, may I speak, please? I think that one of the main reasons why he put in the jobs programs on highways and putting veterans back to work, he was there at the bonus march and the destruction of the World War One veterans and their plea for their money because they were starving.
Yes, he was.
And he saw the destruction and the hatred that it incurred when the U.S. Army had to go in there and hurt American veterans. And he knew that the World War II veterans were home, and they were hurting for jobs, too. And they brought back a lot of armament from World War II. And he knew that he had to keep those veterans working and happy. And that's one of the reasons, the main reasons, why he put in domestic programs to put us back to work. And Tom, you sing
Well, let me just correct the record here, Raul. Most of those programs, like the GI Bill, were not passed by Dwight Eisenhower. They were passed by Harry Truman.
Even better, because Harry Truman was a real Democrat. But he knew. But if I may, some of the things that Eisenhower did internationally, he negated the Accords of 1954. Which would have given Vietnam its freedom and united it under Ho Chi Minh.
Oh, I know. It was during the Eisenhower administration that we screwed up the Middle East, that we screwed up Iran, that we screwed up Iraq, that we screwed up Nicaragua. I can give you a long list. I mean, you know, the Eisenhower administration was in the bag with the United Fruit and ITT. and the CIA and all these activities around the world, and they were all hysterical about the communists. And, you know, there were a lot of things. I'm not trying to idealize the Eisenhower years or the Eisenhower administration. My point is that when it came to domestic policy, making education basically free for that generation of people who came back from World War II, having the government intervene in the housing market so that people could buy their homes, strengthening labor laws and encouraging labor unions, these are all things Eisenhower, Republican, did. Those were good things, and we should do more of those kind of things. It's a bad thing that the CIA got into bed with the United Fruit and did a coup in Nicaragua. I'm with you. So.
Right. And but Ike was at Cold War, if you remember.
Oh,
wasn't
yeah.
he the president when Gary Power was shot down, what brought us to the brink of World War III, too?
Yeah. Although at that point in time, that was after Eisenhower's heart attack, and which was in 58 or 59, late 58, early 59. And after that, pretty much Eisenhower wasn't so much running the government. Nixon was. Although,
and one final point, if I may, he also laid the groundwork for the Bay of Pigs and the invasion that failed.
That was entirely Richard Nixon. Dwight Eisenhower probably didn't even know about that. Richard Nixon put together this group called the Cuba Working Group, as I recall, and they organized the original Bay of Pigs invasion. It was going to be an October surprise that was going to happen in the fall of 1960 in the election of Nixon versus Kennedy. And because of, for a variety of reasons, the main one being weather down in Cuba, Nixon couldn't pull off the invasion. It didn't happen. And so when Kennedy came into office, here were all these guys all ready to invade Cuba, over 10,000 of them at what they called the University of Miami. It was the CIA offices down in Cuba. And they came to him and basically said, if you don't,
TomHartman.com for audio and video archive.
They said, if you don't do this, you're going to have a revolt on your hands. 46 minutes past the hour.
I see trees of green, red roses too. I see them bloom for me and you. And I think to myself, what a wonderful world.
Thanks so much to our show director, Louise Hartman, to our executive producer, Sean Taylor, to our associate producer, Shane Farnan, to our video director, Jim Javinsky, our phone screeners, Paul Edney and Rianne Koch. To writer-researcher Sam Sachs, to Alva Goldbrook for video production. I still got it wrong, didn't I? No? Yes? I don't know. Okay. To our business manager, Nigel Peacock and Jamie Holly, our business manager, Ron Hartenbaum of WYD, to everyone at our syndicators, Dow Global, Pacifica Radio, Free Speech TV on Dish Network, DirecTV, and all the cable providers who carry our show, to Comcast, Manhattan Neighborhood Network, all the others around the country who carry our show, all the great folks at Free Speech TV and RTTV who work on the big picture, to our newsletter editor, Sue Nethercutt, to the folks in our chat room, to Alan Ratner, Victoria Jones, and all the great folks at the Talk Radio News Service, to Jay Goodman Tamboli for our tech support, to our affiliates, both radio and television, to our sponsors, and to you for supporting our program. Thank you. Genuinely appreciated. 866-987-THOM, our telephone number, and Pam in Falls Church, Virginia. Hey, Pam, what's up?
Hi, Tom. How you doing? Big fan of your show. It's interesting you mentioned the D.C. cab driver that was also a listener. I have taken cabs from Northern Virginia for a while, a few years ago, and I noticed a lot of them were very aware of your program.
Huh.
And just want to mention earlier, too, that thank you for the nice words that you said about our beautiful city, Washington, D.C. I came up to D.C. to go to GW grad school. I was there for 30 years. It is a beautiful city.
I love this city. I absolutely love
yeah.
this city. It's the first time I've ever lived in a big city in like downtown,
yeah.
and it is spectacular. I mean, we lived
it
in
is.
The suburbs of Atlanta for 13 years, so I kind of know big cities, but this is just one of the best cities in the world.
It's so nice too, because since 1980, all we've heard is that Washington is a problem and beating up on our beautiful capital. So that's very nice. I had the pleasure and honor of working at the National Archives Smithsonian for years for my career.
Oh, wow.
So, and I've seen a lot of stuff.
I have one of those little ID cards. You know, with my picture on it, I went down, and Louise and I got the got signed in as researchers so that we can. We haven't had the time to spend much time down there. There's also all the military records, and we wanted to look up her dad's records in the Navy and mine in the Army and all this other
stuff. Absolutely. Yeah, the Navy records, World War II, you will have success. A lot of the Army records, unfortunately, were burned in the St. Louis facility, I think, in the 1970s. But didn't want to go off on that. But, I worked with the archivist in the captured German records. The earlier caller was speaking about Eisenhower. Mm-hmm. You know, and would see, you know, all the Zyklon B cans and things like that in the position I was in. And that was really great. But I wanted to get to the topic of the day. You were so great to pick up on the affordable health care, how this message really has to be gotten out. And a couple of your callers touched on the fact that the healthcare.gov site is excellent. Glad to hear about that. But it just needs to be emphasized more and more in print, or I think with other members of the Democratic Party, other people would agree with me, because as you were saying, I mean, it was just minutes yesterday afternoon, and by the last night and this morning, the Republicans were all over it. You know, they on the network news.
The tsunami.
Even Romney having, they were saying, you know, and people's joy yesterday afternoon on TV, on the news, you know, with Romney's earlier involvement with the Massachusetts health care, that didn't even faze him. But you were so similar last night. Rachel Maddow closed on emphasizing how the Democrats better get the word out. And she interestingly showed a photograph of Romney's gubernatorial portrait, which is painted, of course, and it shows him in front of a picture, a flag, and a desk. And on the desk is a photo of his wife, Anne, and a book below that, which has the medical symbol for the health care program that he implemented in that state. But that hasn't even deterred the very outspoken backlash to this. But I think you're right on. Now, one thing, finally, I wanted to mention, and your books are great, and friends on the West Coast in Seattle turned me on to you, and your radio show and your TV. But I just wondered, for people who don't have, a lot of people don't have Internet for either news or other things due to funds or whatever. Have you ever considered or been asked about doing maybe a DVD, you know, for part of the donation for Free Speech TV or for your programming that, you know, people could send to other people for exposure, like, you know, your greatest hits or 10 topics like Social Security?
We haven't done a video, but there is an audio collection that's available through Amazon online. It was published by Barrett Kohler Books. Yeah. And
excellent.
You know, yeah. So, you know, there is some of that stuff out there. Pam, thank you for the call. I want to get a couple more people in here before we hit the end of the hour.
Tom.
Thank you very much. I appreciate it. Paul in Paul, I'm sorry. Mark Canfield Taylor is on, or Taylor. Which is it, Mark? Canfield Taylor?
People get confused. It's Mark Taylor Canfield, Tom.
There you go, Taylor Canfield. Thank you.
A couple quick reports for you on Occupy Movement.
We have about
today.
A minute.
Okay.
No, we have 10 seconds.
Tomorrow is the beginning of our Occupy National Gathering in Philadelphia. It starts tomorrow. I'm presenting a Declaration of Independence from Corporate Domination. And also, UN envoys have sent a letter to Hillary Clinton condemning the police crackdowns on U.S. occupiers. And I think it's a really, really important story that we need to cover.
You're absolutely right. Well said. Mark Taylor Canfield, thank you, Mark, and thanks for the information. Coming up next on the Tom Hartman Program, the right thinks Obamacare is going to open the floodgates to tax-mageddon. Wrong. I'll mix it up with Carrie Lucas, the Independent Women's Forum. Plus, we'll have the best of the rest of the news and your calls right here on the Tom Hartman Program, occupying the media 3 hours a day, 5 days a week for we the people. And don't forget, democracy begins when you show up. Get out there and occupy something. Tag, you're it. We'll see you next week.
You've been listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, go to tomhartman.com.